The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are pronounced herein and are posted on the bulletin board outside this room and in the clerk's office and available for your inspection. There are three causes being submitted today orally. In the order in which they are presented, they are as follows. Ruth G. McGill, M.D. and others versus J. Willis Johnson III from Tom Green County. Beaumont Bank, N.A. versus Patricia H. Butler from Jefferson County. And National Union Fire Insurance Company versus Hudson Energy Company from Gregg County. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each cause. But we will finish the oral arguments before we take our noon lunch break. In each cause, we have allowed a varying amount of time for counsel to argue, and we will announce that prior to the beginning of each argument. Counsel in the second and third causes are requested to remain nearby, although it is not necessary you remain in the courtroom. But we will want to proceed to your matter without delay when we come back from our recesses. All of these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Should anyone desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make application to do so with our clerk. In the cause of McGill versus Johnson, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. Stanley M. Johansson and Mr. George E. Chapman will present argument for petitioners. Mr. Johansson will open.
Would you move this?
Yes, sir.
Anywhere it's going to be, it's going to cover up somebody.
Yeah. Okay. That's a difficulty.
My view is covered. Counsel.
Put it in the exact center.
Okay. That's agreeable. Is that acceptable?
A little bit further back that way. I think we'll be able to see.
Okay. Thank you. May it please the court. I am Stanley Johansson, and along with co-counsel, represent the McGills petitioners in this cause. This is a declaratory judgment action brought to construe the will and codicils of the testator J. Willis Johnson Jr., sometimes referred to as Jake Johnson. This is an appeal from a summary judgment rendered by the trial court in favor of the plaintiff J. Willis Johnson III, which judgment was affirmed by the Austin Court of Appeals with two judges sitting. This court has granted petitioner's application on the first three points of error, all of which relate to one issue, whether Mary Hall's death without descendants during the life tenant's lifetime caused her remainder interest to be defeated so as to result in a partial intestacy under Jake Johnson's will. Now I'm going to begin with some background information concerning the testator's family and the will to show how the facts and the law relate in this case. I will then discuss the distinction between a condition precedent and a condition subsequent, explain why this distinction is critical in this case, and then show how it is that the key provision in this will relating to survival is a divesting condition subsequent, and explain why another condition in the will relating to respondent having children is immaterial to the question before this court regarding the survival condition. Now, by way of background, around the turn of the century, J. Willis Johnson Sr. acquired approximately 100,000 acres of land in and around San Angelo. He and his wife left undivided one-third interest in those 100,000 acres to their three children, J. Willis Johnson, Jr., that's Jake, the testator, Ruth Gordon, and Mary B. Bull. Jake Johnson died in 1955, survived by his son and only child, Willis Johnson III, and by his two sisters and their descendants. Now, testator in his will left his one-third share of these inherited lands and most of his personal property in a trust, which was to terminate when his son reached age 40, at which time the will made alternate gifts. If at that time, age 40, Willis had a child born in lawful wedlock, and he did not, he was to take outright ownership of all the property, including the land. But if Willis did not then have a child, direct issue of his body, born in lawful wedlock, he was to take full title to the personal property, but only a life estate with respect to the land, with the remainder passing to his to the testator's two sisters, Willis III's two aunts. Notice, Jake Johnson, by his will, was willing to give his sisters fee simple ownership and the power of disposition over this land if Willis never had a child. But, Your Honors, the dominant, the overriding theme of this will is that Willis was to have a fee simple estate in his share of the land if and only if he had a child. Now, here is what happened. Mary Hall, one of the sisters of the testator, died in 1984, her daughter having predeceased her, meaning that Mary Hall left no living descendants. The issue in this case is a very clear and very simple and very straightforward one. What happened to Mary Hall's share of the remainder? Now, the Court of Appeals ruled that her share of the remainder lapsed and thus passed by intestacy in Jake Johnson's estate, and that remainder therefore passed to J. Willis Johnson III, giving J. Willis a fee simple ownership in that share of the land. If I may move this one out of the way. The consequence then is the Court of Appeals holding for the respondent turns this will absolutely on its head. Willis has not had any children, and yet the Court of Appeals managed to conclude that this share of the family land nonetheless passed to him in fee simple, giving him the power of disposition. The Court of Appeals decision did the one thing that the testator explicitly stated he did not want to happen. Now, if this decision was somehow compelled by long-established principles of property law, that would be troubling enough. But, Your Honors, the opposite is true. The Court of Appeals' opinion in its analysis is fundamentally wrong as to future interest law and arrived at a classification of estates for which there is no supporting authority. Now, we all know from our law school days that the law of future interest is sometimes known for its complexity. But, Your Honors, the future interest component of this case is simple and straightforward if you focus on the relevant language of the will, the condition concerning Mary's Hall then be deceased. Notice, following the life estate with the remainder passing share and share alike unto my sisters, and here is the critical language, and in case either of said the sisters then be deceased, and in case either of said sisters then be deceased, that share of the remainder shall pass to her descendants. Is that language relating to survival a condition precedent to taking, or is it instead a divesting condition subsequent? Now, in addressing this question, one thing the parties agree on is the applicable rules for classifying conditions tied to remainders, as is set out in all of the treatises and the books. If a language setting forth the condition precedes or is incorporated into the gift of the remainder, it is then a condition precedent. But as this court has often said and held in the past, although in cases raising different issues, if the language setting forth the condition follows the gift language, it is a divesting condition subsequent. Now, the Court of Appeals ruled that this condition, and in case either of said sisters then be deceased, is a condition precedent to taking. That classification, Your Honors, is simply wrong. To the contrary, this language here is a classic, almost textbook example of a divesting condition subsequent. The gift language, with the remainder unto my sisters, is followed by the condition, and in case either of my said sisters then be deceased. The language setting forth the condition follows the language of the gift. Several Texas cases cited in our brief involving virtually the same language, although raising different issues before the court, have held that this language, and in case, following the language of a gift, is a condition subsequent. Another case involved the language, then be deceased, and it was held to be a condition subsequent. The upshot, then, is the Court of Appeals' decision on this classification is simply wrong, raising the question, how did they get there when this classification is so contrary to long-established principles? Well, I will refer to their opinion at pages 9 and 10 under discussion headed lapse. The Court of Appeals stated that this is a condition precedent, and Your Honors, this is a very difficult part of their opinion to follow. They stated that this language, then be deceased, is a condition precedent simply because the language, then be deceased, refers to the time of the life tenant's death, to the time of Willis Johnson's death. The opinion says, and I quote, "We believe then be deceased clearly refers to the death of my said son." Accepting that is probably wrong, but accepting that. Then comes a logic-defying leap, a total gap. Then comes the therefore with no support for the therefore. The opinion says, and I quote again, "The quoted portion of the will conditions the passing of the remainder upon survival." And we don't have to wait until Johnson's death to know that that condition will not occur, end of quote, because Mary Hall has already died. Again, I urge you to read that part of the opinion very carefully. It's quite common in drafting wills and trusts to refer to the death of a life tenant as the time when an interest passes. Read the Court of Appeals opinion and you are going to see that the Court of Appeals has eliminated from Texas jurisprudence an entire class of future interest known as remainder subject to total divestment. There are those who might urge that the law of future interest should be simplified, but I would suggest that this is not the way to go about it. Now, once the condition has been properly classified as a condition subsequent, which is what it is, what happened when Mary Hall died, not survived by descendants? That is the crux of this case. And in my argument, I'm going to give two classroom examples that quite obviously are explained or inspired by the language of Jake Johnson's will. An understanding of these two examples points the way to the proper construction and proper result in this case. Here is the first. "To A for life, then to B. And in case B then be deceased, to B's descendants." Classifying estates in order, A has a life estate, and because of the locational test, the condition follows the gift, B has a remainder subject to a condition subsequent. B's descendants, that's that executory interest. It cannot be a remainder, it is an executory interest, because it divests the preceding estate. Now, as in this case, what happens if B dies during A's lifetime, not survived by descendants? There is no Texas authority directly in point on that question, meaning here is an opportunity to clarify Texas law. But the restatement of property, to which this court has often sought guidance, all of the treatise writers and the authorities are in agreement. Since the condition of survival then be deceased was expressed as a divesting condition subsequent, two conditions and events must occur before B's remainder is divested. First, and obviously and clear to the naked eye, B must die in A's lifetime so as to then be deceased. And here is the fundamental point, there must be holders of an executory interest around, that is, descendants who are around to divest B's estate. Two things have to happen. B has to die in A's lifetime, and there must be holders of an executory interest around to divest B's estate. If there are not, her death without descendants does not defeat the remainder interest. This, Your Honors, is precisely what we have here. Mary Hall's remainder could be defeated only if she died during the life tenant's lifetime, which she did, but also if she left descendants to take under this condition. Since Mary Hall left no descendants, her remainder was not defeated and passed under Mary Hall's will. Now, the unusual feature of this will, which rather obviously confused the Court of Appeals, is that Mary Hall's remainder interest was subject to two different conditions. One as to Willis having children, and the other concerning Mary Hall's death. These two conditions simply must be analyzed separately, because only one deals with Mary Hall's survival and then being deceased. Now, you are going to see and probably hear that respondents place great emphasis on this parenthetical statement at this point, with the remainder subject to the proviso contained in the latter part of this sentence. Respondents argue that this parenthetical, which you will note is not a condition at all, but merely a preview of coming attractions, they're going to argue that this parenthetical, by referring to the proviso down here dealing with the child condition, somehow moves the child condition to this point in the will, making it the child condition, making the child condition a condition preceding. As soon as I find my exciting notes here, we shall continue. However, several things must be noted about this parenthetical statement. First of all, it refers only to the child condition. It has absolutely nothing to do with the parenthetical statement, with the condition concerning Mary Hall's death. Moreover, even if somehow this parenthetical statement changes this condition, the child condition, into a condition precedent, when proper analysis would call it a condition subsequent, but even if it did, this in no way affects the condition of Mary Hall's then being deceased, which is the condition critical to this case. At best, the existence of this parenthetical makes the remainder contingent on Willis not having a child. Now, my example two further illustrates where the Court of Appeals missed the mark. To A for life, and if A has a child, to A and fee simple. But if A does not have a child on A's death to B, once again, we classify estates in order. If A has a child here is a condition precedent because it's incorporated into the gift itself, meaning A has a life estate and contingent remainder, meaning also B has an alternate contingent remainder. But now we come to the critical question. Is B's contingent remainder in this case contingent on surviving A? And the answer, Your Honors, is a firm no. The only condition to B's taking is that A not have a child. While no Texas case has addressed this important issue, every English jurist case and most American decisions, more precisely all but three, have uniformly held that just because a remainder is contingent on some other issue, that does not by itself also make the interest subject to a condition precedent of survival. The three American cases that come out the other way are all cited in the third edition of my casebook at page 730, two of them followed by critical law review notes for being incorrectly decided, the third one, a North Carolina case, a lead case in the book, not because it correctly states the law, but to enable the students to see the mistake in the court's analysis. No. Virtually every court that has considered this question...
We on the verge of getting into textbooks?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the fourth edition will soon be at your local bookstore, and that's why I had to refer to the... but I don't expect a large line outside the bookstore to get the fourth edition.
But we won't be in that. We'll have to be in the fifth.
Okay, all right. Well, that's true. If left to stand, the Court of Appeals holding, vastly at odds with precedent from other jurisdictions, is going to confuse this important area of law. As a final note, let me say something about the purposes of these rules of construction and... Excuse me. Oh, is that what that red light is? I shall come back. Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that.
25 minutes, please.
I think we need all the help we can get on this.
Yes, I can understand that. If I may, Your Honors, I urge that you review these two examples with care, which when added together produce example three, which mercifully I will not go through, but comes remarkably close to the essence of the will and the critical language of Jake Johnson's will. I also must urge you to read Respondent's brief with caution, because it contains a dismaying number of misstatements as to this area of the law. I have time to give just a few examples.
Before you do that.
Yes, sir.
Mr. J. Willis Johnson
is still alive, is still capable of having children. If J. Willis Johnson III has a child, this case is over. He will have a fee simple. But the fact that that event has not yet occurred, although it might in the future, in no way affects the proper treatment of Mary Hall's remainder interest on the survival question. No question. This case is over if J. Willis Johnson III has a child. But once again, that condition does not speak to the condition of survival of Mary B. Hall. A different condition in the will speaks to that. Judge Heck?
If after the trust had terminated, the son survived one aunt but predeceased the other, and neither aunt was survived by descendants, what would be the result?
Well, first of all, one aunt, Ruth Gordon, has died.
In this case.
In this case, and consequently, it has already passed to her estate.
Under this will, if Johnson had predeceased one of his aunts, which has not happened, but the other aunt had predeceased him, and neither aunt had descendants, who would take it?
Under this analysis, the one half, the aunt who survived, let's assume it was Ruth Gordon, she would take one half of the remainder, or if she had left descendants, which actually took place, they would take one half of the remainder. The other one half would pass under Mary Hall's will. There is a basis for arguing this should be treated as class gift, that the surviving class members should take. It is developed in the brief. It is an uphill argument, although there's basis for it, since the beneficiaries, the remainder men, were individually named. As I have set forth these rules of construction and classification, they appear rather mechanical, sort of ours is not to reason why approach to the law. I suggest, Your Honors, that these rules do serve important policies very much involved in this case if we're to give effect to Jake Johnson's predominant intent. As this court has said repeatedly in the past, where a person makes a will, it is presumed that he intended to dispose of all of his property and not die partial intestate as to any part thereof. I will say this. I taught wills for years. I've read a lot of wills cases. I have seen few cases where the testator's intent is so strikingly clear. Jake Johnson did not want his son Willis to have a fee simple and the power of disposition unless he had a child, direct issue of his body, born in lawful wedlock. If he did not have a child, he wanted the land to pass to other members of the family. The two courts below not only managed to come up with a decision that frustrated this clearly expressed intent, but upon close examination it can be seen that they misapplied long-established principles of property law. And it is for these reasons, Your Honors, petitioners urge that this court reverse the Court of Appeals and render judgment for the petitioners.
Paul died testate. Is that correct? And under her will...
She left the property to this line of the fence. Under her will, the property was passed to her niece, Ruth McGill, who disclaimed on behalf of her children, grandnephew and niece of Mary B. Hall.
I think the CA opinion says that one half is left in a life trust to her nephew. Is that right? To Johnson III?
That is correct.
So half in life, life trust to...
That's correct.
Her sister's family.
A life estate only, and on his death, it will go down, stay in the McGill family.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from the respondent.
Please, the court, Mr. Tom Allen Cunningham will present argument for respondent.
Somebody must have given the speeches on this already.
You can put these charts on either side. I just report the study like in the block pamphlet.
If it please the court, my name is Tom Cunningham, and I, along with my senior partner Henry Gissel and Truett Smith from San Angelo, are here to represent Willis Johnson III, who is alive and who's sitting with us today, and who is the subject of this lawsuit. Mr. Johansson is correct that this is a will construction case. And the fundamental issue in this case is, what was the nature of the remainder interest mentioned in the will of Willis's father, J. Willis Johnson III? Now, the important point about this case is its significance in the construction of this particular document. I was here, as some of you may remember, 2 or 3 weeks ago. We were talking about a question of whether or not an amended pleading or an answer was sufficient to avoid a dismissal by a plaintiff. And I see by Justice Hightower's recent opinion that that issue has been a concern to this court in other cases as well. But those are procedural points. Those issues will be resolved and the parties will go to trial and they'll have their substantive issues resolved. The importance of this case and the awesome responsibility of this court is that in construing this will, you will forevermore, as the final arbiter, tell us and tell Willis Johnson III what his father meant when he wrote his will. And he'll live with that for the rest of his life. And so it's an awesome responsibility to look at the will and to construe its provisions. And the law is clear as to how you do that. In construing the will, all its provisions should be looked to for the purpose of ascertaining what the real intention of the testator was. And if this can be ascertained from the language of the instrument, then any particular paragraph of the will, which considered alone would indicate a contrary intent, must yield to the intention manifested by the whole instrument. Fundamentally, one looks to the will to determine the intent of the testator. There are no laws, there's no statute that tells you what the result of this case will be. There's no case law, ultimately, that will tell you what the result of this case will be. The result of this case is dictated by, fundamentally, the will of J. Willis Johnson, Jr. Now, the family, you've seen a little about the family as background for the issues that give rise to this case. And you've seen that Mr. Johnson, Jr. died in 1955. The will in this case, by the way, was written in 1944 when Willis was 13 years old. Mr. Johnson III, Willis, our client, is still alive. And you see that Mrs. Gordon, who has died, the testator's sister, has left descendants. And so that portion of the will which Mr. Johansson has brought to your attention calls into play with respect to the question of as between Ruth Gordon
and her descendants, what happens to that remainder? Mr. Johansson hasn't called your attention to that portion of the will which determines as between Mary B. Hall, who died without descendants, and Willis Johnson, what happens to that remainder? And we'll talk about the significance of that in a few moments. It's interesting to note that Mary B. Hall, who died in 1984, the testator's sister, had a daughter who was alive at the time of the writing of the death of J. Willis Johnson, Jr., and who was alive at the time of the termination of the testamentary trust, but who died untimely after Willis, Jr. had died, but before either Mary Hall and, of course, before Willis Johnson. So we deal with the provisions of the will, which determine the nature of the remainder interest. Looking at the provisions of the will, we see the fundamental paragraph that controls the decision in this case. If my son, J. Willis Johnson, lives to reach the age of 40 years old, it was 35, but by a consul, it was changed to 40. And if at that time he reaches the age of 40, he does not then have a living child, direct issue of his body, born in lawful wedlock. Then under those conditions, and at that time, there shall vest. The interesting point about this case is that you can change the terminology and make it sound a lot different than it really is. Whether you call it a remainder subject to a condition precedent or a contingent remainder, as opposed to a remainder subject to a condition subsequent or a vested remainder, can make a whole lot of difference in how things appear. But what we're really talking about, and what the language that the courts have used in dealing with this matter, is whether or not the remainder is a contingent remainder or whether it is a vested remainder. And we will see that the testator, this will very carefully, chose his words to describe the nature of the interest in his undivided real property that he wanted to have. And he said that if at the time of the termination of the trust, Willis does not have a child, there shall vest in my said son the full and complete title to the personal property, then constituting any part of the trust estate held by the trustee under this will, and there shall vest in him for the term of his natural life, a life estate, and all the real estate, then held by the trustee and any part of the trust estate under this will, with the remainder over in said real estate at the death of my said son. Mr. Johansson in his brief suggests that those words are surplusage, that you should not consider at the death of my said son.
Whether you consider them or not, didn't the aunts at the time the trust terminated have a remainder interest in the life estate of Mr. Johnson?
How could you know what interest they would have until you knew whether Willis would have a child? That's the whole point in this case. At the time Mrs. Hall died, at the time we sit here today, you cannot say that Mrs. Hall had an interest in this property because at any time, whether it's remainder or not.
Exclusive of that condition, setting that aside for just a moment, because I take it that petitioner acknowledges, as he did rather dramatically in his argument, that if Mr. Johnson has a child, then the case is over. I believe is
that is dramatic and that is funny.
But putting that aside for a moment, however you read the words at the death, don't the aunts at the termination of the trust have some kind of remainder interest subject to divestment in this life estate?
They have a contingent remainder interest, which by its very nature is not, as you refer to it, subject to divestment. And that's the point. The petitioners contend that this is, in essence, a vested remainder subject to divestment, that Mrs. Hall has the vested remainder interest, and it can be taken away later. Fundamentally, Mr. Johnson said in his will that the remainder is to be a contingent remainder, and therefore it does not arise until the occurrence of the events, the contingent events. And the will sets forth what those contingent events are.
If after the trust had terminated, the son had survived one of his aunts, one aunt died after the trust terminated, but before Mr. Johnson. And the other died after Mr. Johnson died. And neither of the aunts died with the sentence. What would be the result, in your view, under this will?
If Mr. Johnson had filed the aunt, no. The aunt dying before the bequest of, and without the sentence, as is the case with Mary B. Hall, the person in question here, the contingent remainder lapsed. And so she had no interest in the property.
But the aunt who died after without descendants?
We don't know. And that's the point. Because we don't know whether at the time Willis dies, whether or not he will have
descendants. No. I'm posing another hypothetical. I'm supposing Mr. Johnson, I don't mean this personally, but I'm supposing that he is already deceased. That's not what happened in this case. But had he already deceased? Had one aunt lived after he did, and one aunt died before he did, under this will, neither aunt had children, would the aunts take or not?
You're assuming that he died without children.
Yes.
And so you're assuming the fact, not the uncertainty that is the case in this will.
Right.
And the answer to that would be the event that gives rise to the occurrence of the remainder interest. Willis dying without having had a child. The contingent event occurred. Gives rise to the remainder.
But neither aunt had had descendants, and one aunt was already dead.
That's correct.
So it seems to me under your theory, one aunt would not take and one aunt would.
That's correct. Now, that
doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't seem to make sense that one aunt would, under those circumstances, neither aunt had descendants, one aunt takes, one aunt doesn't, and part of it goes back to Mr. Johnson's estate.
Well, it makes sense if you consider what Mr. Johnson wanted, and he wanted the contingent remainder interest to pass to the two sisters. And if one of them died before Willis did, that contingency would not have arisen. Now,
it would have gone to her sentence, wouldn't it?
No, it would not have. If the sister died before Willis did,
the contingency could not occur. The contingent event here is Willis dying without having children. Because you never know, Mrs. Hall on her deathbed would never know whether she had an interest in this property or not. She could never say, I have an interest in this property. As Mr. Johansson has pointed out, in order for the remainder to be vested, there must be a person of certain identity in being at the time of the passing of the interest that would be available to receive the interest upon the termination of the intervening estate. Now, Mrs. Hall cannot be that person because there is no person today of certain identity who would be available at the termination of the life estate because at any time Mr. Johnson may have a child. Now, the critical point, I think, is, again, what Mr. Johnson said about the nature of the interest he was passing. He wrote a codicil, which the petitioners have never mentioned in their brief, and they've never mentioned in the argument. And they would ask you to overlook it, but you can't overlook it. Wills and codicils are construed together. And he said, Mr. Johnson said in 1946, in that paragraph of my will, I provided that under the contingency therein set forth, my sister Ruth Gordon and Mary B. Hall are the direct lineal descendants shall receive the remainder of real estate upon the termination of the life estate therein provided. And I provide that under the contingency therein made, they shall receive the trust property. The facts are that, as he provided in an earlier provision of this codicil, he was contemplating marriage. And he was thinking he might have other children. And he said in his will, I provide that all of my 12 children should be treated the same way as Willis, and that they should take the same interest that Willis should take, and that if there is a remainder interest based on the contingency provided in the will, then it should arise under the same conditions and contingencies as set forth in the will. So that my sisters and the direct lineal descendants, and this answers your question, Judge, taking only upon the death of the last survivor of the family children. J. Willis Johnson said in his will, let's look at that one, Willis. And when he had thought he was going to have more children, he said, let's look at this with all of the children of Israel, and let's see if they've had kids. And if they've had kids, we'll talk about a remainder interest.
But if they haven't had children, there isn't going to be a remainder interest.
There is a suggestion in the briefs that had the testator been presented with the, all of these scenarios, and had he been asked to decide whether he wanted his estate to pass through his aunt's estates or through his son's estate, he might pick the former because potentially under his son's estate, his first wife might take.
Well,
what's the response to that?
The response to that is twofold. Number one, that's
obviously speculation that doesn't occur in the record. The first wife is dead, so that's not a possibility. The second point is that the first codicil, it seems to me, totally negates that. Because in 1946, 2 years after he wrote the first, you know, the original will, he was concerned about his second wife. And he could have changed those provisions had he wanted to, but he didn't. What he was concerned about was his second wife and his other children. And if he was so concerned about Willis doing something of that nature that he perhaps didn't want to happen, if you can read this in there somehow, then he would not have written that all of my other children take under the same circumstances. Furthermore, Judge Heck, clearly, this will was written very carefully, and the words were chosen very carefully. And had he said, had he wanted to cut his first wife out under all circumstances, it seems very clear that his scrivener knew how to do it, could have done it in very clear language, but that language does not appear in the will.
Well, I think there is some unclarity in the use of the word remainder. It seems to me that, on the one hand, the will seems to be using the remainder in the sense of what is someone is actually going to get when the life estate terminates. And on the other hand, of course, the remainder refers to what you have when the life estate is created. Some expectancy.
One's a contingent remainder, and the other's a vested remainder.
Not set out, though, quite so clearly in the will.
Well, I think it is, and I don't mean to argue with the court, and I don't mean to force your question. If you had a question, I'm ready to respond.
No, that's my problem. Folks,
well, the will, again, answers that problem, because the testator very carefully chose, choosing his words, said when he wanted an interest to vest, he used the word vest. But when he talked about the remainder, he used the word pass. You will never find the word vest appear in this will with respect to the remainder interest. But most importantly, I wonder if Mr. Johansson, in the new edition of his book, will include the same rubric that he included in the last edition, whether the remainder is vested subject to divestment or is contingent. That's the issue we're talking about. Depends upon whether the conditional event is expressed as a condition subsequent or a condition present. Whether a condition is precedent or subsequent, and here you see the interchange of the two labels I was talking about, the vested remainder and the contingent remainder, and the condition subsequent and the condition precedent. Whether a condition is precedent or subsequent depends, with few exceptions, on the sequence of the words used in the instrument. Interests are classified in sequence. I believe he said that in those words during his argument. If the condition is incorporated into the gift of the remainder, if it comes, so to speak, between the commas, setting apart the remainder, the condition is precedent. If it comes between the commas, it's a condition precedent. Your Honors, it comes between the parentheses, and it's a condition precedent. Willis Johnson, in using the very formula that Professor Johansson has set forth, said with remainder, here's the bequest of the remainder, over in said real estate at the death of my said son, comma or parenthesis, subject to the proviso contained in the latter part of this sentence. Mr. Johansson said, disregard that. That's just a, quote, preview of coming attraction. Your Honors, I don't think you can disregard a provision of the will as important as that. Mr. Johansson says, I don't know what that's referring to. It's subject to the proviso contained in the latter part of this sentence, and you don't have to go very far to find the word proviso. However, that if my status is on after said life of faith has vested in him upon reaching the age before he does have a child, right? Just a little preview of coming attraction. Your Honors, I don't think you can disregard a provision of the will that's important to that. Mr. Johansson says, I don't know what that's referring to. It's subject to the proviso contained in the latter part of this sentence that ignores the will very far by the word provide. However, the mindset is on after said like the faith has rested in him upon a reason before he does have a child. It goes on and says if he does have a child, then sisters don't get any. Fundamentally, we're talking about a life estate in my son. These simple titles. If he has a child. If he dies without having a child, remainder to my sister. He dies with a child. Be simple. That's what the testator said in Willie Ward. That's what the construction adopted by the Court of Appeals in Texas was. Mr. Johansson would prefer that you disregard, and he said so in his oral argument, he preferred that you disregard the condition having to do with this childbirth. But that's the fundamental condition that we're talking about. He would prefer that you talk about as between Mary B. Hall and her descendant, Sal, who gets it. He preferred that you talk about the condition having to do with survival of the descendants of the sister. But you never get that. You don't even start talking about that until you know whether Willis Johnson has died without a child. Fundamentally, an interest never arose in Mary B. Hall because there was never a person of certain identity capable of receiving the remainder interest upon termination of the intervening life. The Court of Appeals was eminently correct in reaching the decision that the remainder interest bequested under the will of J. Willis Johnson, in accordance with the terms of the will, and in accordance with the terms of the first codicil construed together, as they should be. The condition that Willis not have a child was incorporated in the same sentence as the bequest of the remainder. The condition was imposed before the bequest to Mrs. Hall. You won't find a reference to Mrs. Hall in this will until you've already accepted the condition. The will described Willis' life estate as vested. It also described Willis' interest upon having a child as vested. The bequest of the remainder was, however, described as passing. Mr. Johnson or his scrivener knew how to use the word vest to communicate his intent. And the words vested or vesting are never used in reference to Mrs. Gordon or Mr. Hall.
The effect of it, though, is, the practical effect is that if you're correct, then Mr. Johnson takes now a portion of the estate in fee.
That's correct.
If you're incorrect, then it remains to be seen how the fee passes.
That's the whole reason why I'm correct, though, Jeff.
I understand that. Mr. Johansson argues that there's one thing that's clear from the will altogether. It's that we're not supposed to know the answer to that question until we know whether Mr. Johnson has a child.
And precisely this court cannot determine that because we don't know that. And that's why the remainder is a contingent remainder. That's the fundamental point. Mr. Johansson would cite you to rules of construction, presumptions of early vesting. He cited cases from all over the place that appear in his casebook. And those rules are helpful. And those rules are certainly helpful where there's a question as to the intent of the testator from the language used in his will. But this court back in 1887 in McMurray versus Stanley said, at most it is but a rule. Technical in nature, based upon a presumed intent of a testator, which ought never to be given controlling effect when, by the clear language of a will, it appears that the testator intended another result. Any other ruling may make the intention of a testator depend upon a presumption of fact, when the testator, by his own language, has made his intention clear, and thus left no occasion for indulging in presumption. It's always dangerous to adopt arbitrary rules for the construction of testamentary paper. One shouldn't read quotes to the Supreme Court of Texas, and I appreciate that, but that one tells it to me. One shouldn't adopt arbitrary rules for the construction of testamentary papers because there is no statute, there is no case. This is the will of J. Willis Johnson, Jr. Only he knew what he meant. Only he had the capacity to put it down in writing. And, Your Honors, I respectfully submit that he put it down in writing. And then he clarified it. And he told you exactly what he wanted. and this is what he wanted. We submit that the intent of J. Willis Johnson on this will is abundantly clear. The trial court was correct. The Court of Appeals was correct. We ask that the Court of Appeals be correct.
Counsel, does the record reflect how old Mr. Willis Johnson III is?
Mr. Johnson is in his late 50s. He'll be 60 this year. Any other questions? I'll be glad to answer. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
By way of rebuttal, Your Honors, I note with interest that not once in that presentation was there explicit reference to the language that has to be construed as to its effect, and in case either of my said sisters then be deceased. We had a lot of talk about the condition of having a child as to whether that is a contingent remainder or a vested remainder. Once again, Your Honors, the mere fact that a remainder is a contingent remainder on some other condition does not alone and by itself make that contingent remainder also contingent on survivals. Again, virtually unanimous authority.
If the last proviso concerning whether a child is born were a condition precedent, that would not affect your argument.
Absolutely not. It happens to be wrong, but we'll concede that point. If this is to be called a contingent remainder, call it a contingent remainder as to the child condition. But this separate condition must be addressed separately. I would also point out, Your Honors, and there are some fundamental misstatements in the respondent's brief. They have been repeated today. Respondent places great emphasis on the fact that the word vest was employed at some parts of the will and not in others, as though that is fraught with significance. Nothing could be further from the truth. That ignores a fundamental distinction between vested in interest on the one hand and vested in possession on the other hand, a distinction that this court has long and properly recognized. To A for life, and on A's death, title shall vest in B. We got that one in first year property, simply because on A's death, title shall vest in B. That has nothing to do with the fact that B has got a vested remainder. Respondent places great emphasis on the use of the word passing, as though that is fraught with significance. Those terms vesting and passing have nothing to do with the classification of a condition preceding or a condition subsequent. And on A's death, title shall pass to B. That has nothing to do with the fact that B has a vested remainder. And if it says, and on A's death, title shall vest in B, if B is then living, look at the language of the condition, not these words which are throwing around when they're clearly speaking of vesting in possession as distinguished from vesting in interest. We don't want to ignore this provision. The petitioner doesn't want to ignore it and say anything you want about the parenthetical. I don't see any condition there. It's a preview of coming attractions. Do whatever you wish with it. But the proviso contained in the latter part of this sentence is the proviso concerning Willis having a child. It is expressed clearly as a divesting condition subsequent. Respondent wants to make it a condition preceding. Okay. It has nothing to do with the issue of survival. Please don't overlook the codicil, it has been argued, because the codicil refers to, quote, subject to the contingencies therein set forth. Interestingly, all of respondents' case is based on labels. Of course the will had contingencies, but that doesn't speak at all to whether those contingencies were conditions preceding or conditions of subsequent. Of course the condition subsequent is a contingency. You've got to review and analyze the words used by the testator in order to classify. Again, perhaps most mystifying example two. To A for life, and if A has a child, to him it be simple. But if A does not have a child, then A's death to B. Review what respondent has said. He has said, we don't know if B has a remainder interest. We won't know until we find out if A has a child or not in the future. Your Honors, I don't know how to respond to that. I simply don't know how to respond to that. Since about the 14th century,
It has long been recognized simply because we don't know whether this future event is going to take place. There is no question but that B has a present interest, a future interest.
Thank you very much.
Many council have objections to leaving their charge for its use.
Not often.
No, sir.
That concludes the argument and the first call. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.